Earth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 17. How long have these ships been here on this planet? Asked Wes Morley, looking across the control console to Semyaza, standing with his back to the wall of displays behind him. Since before history began, said Semyaza after a short pause. Mortals do not live long enough to be a threat to an angel that lives for 40 millennia. But the human spirit is eternal, and somehow they have been provided a path to greater glory that has never been afforded to angels. The fact that the younger brother had been given this inheritance was the source of numerous wars in heaven, and the rage that powered the Dark Prince's armies on thousands of worlds throughout the universe. The Air Force has been chasing these things since we learned to fly, said Wes, pressing his case for disclosure. You were not the first Air Force, said Semyaza, trivializing his inquiry. You know, we have shot many of them out of the sky and splattered them across low orbit, said Wes. You admit, though, they have shown restraint, yes? Asked Semyaza. I thought you said there were rules. If you mean they could have turned and swatted our jets out of the sky like insects? Yes. The human body does not like to make a right-hand turn at Mach 8, said Wes. The rules are vague when it gets to this phase of a planet's development. The small ships are something to behold in this dimension, don't you think? Said Semyaza, measuring Wes and trying to change the subject. Vague is what you do best, isn't it? Said Wes with an edge to his voice. My pilots say the cockpits are too small, said Wes. You have been my student for nearly a decade, General. You must have learned by now the power of silence, said Semyaza. When do I get to see them? Demanded Wes. You lack patience, as usual, General. They will land at the airport just after dawn, said Semyaza, folding his hands behind his back. Inviting attack. Wes stood up slowly from the console. He carefully took off his dress blue jacket and hung it on the back of the swivel chair. He walked slowly along the console to the end, turned with military crispness toward Semyaza, and looked up into his human-like face. Like teeth on a key, the words slid out of his mouth. When gods are no longer worshipped, they die. Their universe passes away as the glory required to energize chaos to form this third dimension stops flowing. In the first few nanoseconds of creation, the stars leap from darkness and begin spewing elements into the void. But as the Creator favors one over the other, promises and fails to deliver, blesses with empty hands, the prayers stop coming, the glory slows down, and within a few millennia the collapse begins. In all of this, one force endures, said Wes as he put his hands slowly and fearlessly on his hips. Glory is a much misunderstood concept, said Semyaza, knowing not to move. You have managed to keep the source hidden from the beginning, said Wes. I would sooner tell a cow that it was the source of milk for a bowl of Wheaties, said Semyaza. Not everyone eats Wheaties, said Wes, also without moving. Do you want to see the ships, or don't you? Said Semyaza, forcing the conversation back to the cards in his hand. I asked you for technology, not spiritual enlightenment, said Wes, as though he was talking to a second lieutenant. I should be amused, General, said Semyaza, withdrawing from the match, but still unwilling to move his hands from behind his back. You didn't know he was communicating with me directly, did you? Asked Wes, watching intensely. Semyaza moved his hands from behind his back and took a long step forward with the speed that belied his 12-foot stature, stopping abruptly within reach of the general. Remember your place, General. said Semyaza, deepening his voice with an effort not to yell that did not go unnoticed. I will disclose my order of operations when I am ready. If you will excuse me, I have ships to review, said Wes, bringing his feet together, making a slow right face, and stepping toward the chair to recover his jacket. He slipped it on and smoothly thumbed the buttons through their holes. I'd invite you to accompany me, but the tunnel shuttle is more like a sewer pipe with bucket seats, made for humans. Use the comm if you wish to reach me. Wes moved in a smooth march toward the stairs that led to the main hall of the NORAD facility. He waited for Semyaza to speak or scream at him, or to leap on him and tear his head from his shoulders with one motion. He had a place for such fear, carved deep inside him decades ago. His only care about whether he lived or died was embodied in his desire to finish what he had started. There were special moments where Lucifer took things into his own hands. Sometimes the job had to be done right. Sometimes the job required a level of temptation that only he could deliver. But Lucifer had limitations. There were places he could not go. There was a place that only humans completing a mortal life could go. Eternal beings, with their right of inheritance intact, could slip through the ever-present cracks in the armor of righteousness and deliver a mortal wound. Wes Morley was molded, beaten, and ultimately defeated by a mother driven insane by missed opportunities and layers of inspired betrayals. His survival attracted mercy, the refusal of which turned him into a flawless crystal victim. He was perhaps the most complete demon Lucifer had ever created. With his first estate intact, through his mortality, his potential was greater than even Lucifer deserved, a fact that did not please Semyaza. The freshly baked wheat bread was sliced 19 millimeters thick, lightly toasted and buttered with real butter. The two eggs were cooked over medium, with their yolks positioned in the center of the two separate eggs. There were two strips of bacon placed parallel to one another on the right side of the plate, and a teaspoon of freshly ground pepper had been placed in a small condiment cup next to a spotless glass filled with 200 milliliters of orange juice. The coffee was freshly ground and brewed to be strong and poured black into a clean mug. "Breakfast is squared away, General," said the airman, standing at attention as Wes sat down at the private table, separated from the rest of the mess hall by a temporary dividing wall. Wes looked at the large plasma screen he had mounted to the wall with a live camera view of Red Rocks National Park. The horizon was pink, and the plasma borealis snaked green through the southern sky, still showing a few stars before being washed out by the rising sun. "That will be all, Airman," said Wes in his technical tone. He finished his breakfast in silence, imagining what the scene on the large screen beside him smelled like. Within 30 minutes he had brushed his teeth again, made sure his medals were straightly pinned on his dress blue jacket, and was walking down the wide stairs toward the tube shuttle station. Funded in secret with billions that often fell through the cracks in the Pentagon accounting system, the tube shuttle was the fastest mode of transportation to the city underneath the Denver airport. A fast escape route deep under the mountains to Grand Junction had been added in less than a year, and work was being done to connect with a tunnel under construction from Edwards Air Force Base. During the Obama administration, accounting oversight was shifted to the White House. Within 7 years, nearly $5 trillion ruptured the Pentagon as money was laundered through dozens of military contractors and bundlers of cash to create what the president called the Islamic State. Admittedly, the anomalous election of Robert Riker stopped the global effort just short of its coordinated goal to destroy America from within. The shuttle was glistening red, white, and blue with a molded Lexan windshield. The tunnel was smoothly cut through the deep granite and basalt layers 3,000 feet underground. Massive fans removed the air ahead of the shuttle, while electromagnetic rails could propel the shuttle to speeds of 400 miles an hour, while levitating it at nearly frictionless distance above the guide rails. The 96 miles from NORAD to Denver took approximately 12 minutes when it was full of passengers. This morning, there was only one. The airman opened the shuttle doors and waited for the general to enter and walk to the front seat with a clear view of the overhead LED lights forming a straight white line all the way to the airport shuttle station. The doors closed and Wes could hear the airlock slightly lower the pressure of the container to strengthen the outer shell. The acceleration was quite a bit less than piloting a fighter jet off a carrier, but it was still a great feeling. The short ride was quiet, providing a slight sensation of speed when looking up at the LED lights on the ceiling. The shuttle began slowing within 10 minutes and came to a pre-programmed soft stop 2 minutes later. There were 2 MPs waiting at the station as ordered. There were no throngs of majors and colonels looking for a promotion. No females were ever allowed at his meetings. He stood, careful not to reveal any unsteadiness. The reflection off the polished aluminum panel by the door confirmed his tie was perfectly straight and in the exact center of the collar of his crisply starched light blue shirt. He returned the salute of the MPs and slid onto the rear seat of the electric shuttle cart as he settled his hat 2 fingers above the bridge of his nose and put his hands in his lap. His military bearing was superlative as the cart reached the end of the tube shuttle access hall and turned toward the main hangar. The heels of nearly 500 airmen and Marines coming together echoed off the arching underground ceiling deep under the Denver airport. Wes could feel his heart beat quicken with pride as he exerted his attention to remember this moment. The years commanding under Semyaza's tutelage from under Cheyenne Mountain left him strangely affected by the presence of so many obedient soldiers and airmen. He was careful not to let his attention drift beyond each moment now as it unfolded. He did not want to forget a name or a face, or ask anything to be repeated. The cart came to a stop, and he walked past the rows of men standing at attention. He turned on the balls of his feet at a right angle and walked quietly across the front of the formation, looking to his right at the faces of every man in that row. He could sense their fear. They were afraid that the world was changing. Many of them had lost their families as they came home from their shift to find their home empty. There was no official direction yet, but they would not leave their brothers in the military. It was a bond, carefully crafted by military psychologists, to keep warfighters uncompromised by their families, or their lovers, or their enemies. He halted at the end of the line, face left, and marched slowly to the microphone, waiting for him in silence. He looked forward under the brim of his hat, sure that it was parallel to the heads of the assembly before him. "At ease," he said deeply, and listened for the echo of his voice and the shuffling feet and hands in synchronized obedience. He moved his head slightly to the left, and then swept his eyes across the ranks to the right. He felt the power of his silence. He held them in it for a few more moments. His hands remained at his sides, his fingers slightly curled and motionless. He sensed the crease in his dress blue trousers was unbroken, slightly bent as the pant leg rested on the polished black leather low quarters. He loathed Corfam shoes with their counterfeit shine, now permitted by the uniform guidelines. There was something lazy about a man who would not work for his own shine on his own shoes with polish and spit. There was respite in the ritual of shining shoes while listening to a good ball game on the radio. Fear. For centuries we have delivered it to our enemies. Make no mistake, my brothers. Fear is not applied very effectively through remote controls and autonomous weapons. No, sir. It is fashioned from the heart and soul of the soldier as he runs with all his might across the morning fields at his enemy who waits for the blade. Will swiftness triumph over brute strength or size? Will the sharpest swords or the longest spears be more effective? Whose blood will soak the ground this day? Whose flesh will feed the vultures for the coming weeks? I tell you, none of these things will deliver victory from the battlefield. It is only fear that secures this greatest gift of humankind. Even the animals fear man. I can tell you with confidence that you are members of the mightiest military force in the history of the world. All of our enemies have fallen, not through the superiority of our weapons, but through the overwhelming application of fear to the battlefield. Even when our enemy moved the battle to neighborhoods and city streets, they could not escape the energy of your hearts and your desire to see them surrender with their faces lowered. What you are about to see today is a weapon system that has been here since long before modern history began, before the Romans, before Noah, before Adam, before the zenith of mankind that is buried deep under the sea and in the valleys that once were mountains. These ships circled the globe. The wars they fought ended civilizations. Their weapons caused the earth to swallow continents. Each of you will be trained to man stations on these ships. Because our will shall be done, your ships will annihilate our final enemy. Now, let me be clear. There is a man masquerading as the president. He has dismantled our government. He has ignored the rule of law. He has seized control of the wealth of the entire world, acting more like a king than a single branch of a constitutional government. He has ordered Congress and the Senate to disband. He has illegally occupied an entire planet that belongs to we the people, and I have been assigned to get it back. He has taken possession of the entire economy of the world. He has taken your families from you. I am the commander-in-chief in this world, and you are my elite warfighters. I promise you, the finest, most powerful weapons that have ever existed on this planet. In the next few days, you will learn many technical things. Know that in mastering these technologies and following my command, that you will get your families back. But you must be resolute in your duty. Do I have your resolution? Boomed Wes from the microphone. Sir, yes, sir, the assembly echoed off the cavernous ceiling. Are you ready to begin? Barked the general. Sir, yes, sir, even louder. Wes paused, knowing he was completely present in the moment. He did not move his arms. He did not change his facial expression. All his energy was focused on that microphone. The power of his silence engulfed every living soul within the sound of his voice at this exact point in time. Call them out, Colonel. His soft words barely echoed off the walls, but it reached the very core of each being under his spell. Flight! Attention! Yelled the colonel, standing to his left. Platoon leaders, move to the airfield! Shouted the colonel. The platoon leader to the far right made a left face and ordered his men, column left, march! Column left, march! Column right, march! He spat, counting out the left and right steps to make sure his men moved as one disciplined and trained formation of flight support crew. When they were clear, the next platoon duplicated the commands and followed close behind the first. The process continued with the last platoon presenting arms to salute their commander-in-chief. The footsteps fell in unison, providing General Westmoreland one great pleasure of his career, to watch men and equipment move at his will. West did an about-face and walked slowly to the electric cart waiting behind him. The cart moved ahead of the marching men along their right and headed for the open hangar vault doors up the sloping concrete road to the daylight outside. The cool, dry air of the surface world smelled good as it cooled the slight perspiration on his face. He had spent the last few years in the presence of an ancient 12-foot being covered in white fur who had built a global network of deception and financial domination that had nearly enslaved the entire race of mankind. He had crafted religions and then pitted those religions against one another for more than 2 millennia. He had taught the process of alchemy to men lustful for power and wealth beyond measure, who deceived the entire world by turning worthless paper and ciphers into gold. The personal power and patience required to withstand the presence of a nearly timeless intelligence has killed every man before him, but nothing prepared him for what was waiting on the outside of that doorway. Denver Airport has the longest runway in the nation at 16,000 feet. The three ships hovered motionlessly, side by side, about 100 feet above the concrete, extended another 3 miles past the end of the runway. His driver let off the accelerator and nearly let the cart come to a stop. "Continue on, soldier," said Wes. Taller than a 50-story building, each craft was smooth and flawless on the outside, with 4 rows of windows near the bottom and 10 rows of windows near the top. The bottom was flat and slightly flared with the sides and top shaped like a bell. They shone in the nearly noon sun like 3 mountains of chrome silver. The cart approached the edge of the shade made by the craft on the far right. Standing alone under the ship was the figure of a man. He was wearing a black uniform with a gold belt, and he could see a blade-shaped hat on his head. The general pointed toward the figure, and the driver steered for his location. Within a minute, the cart came to a rest, and the general stepped out of the cart and walked up to the figure like he was ready for inspection. The figure moved slightly, and his face became apparent. It was bronze in color with large, bright blue eyes. There was hair on the head, but it was closely and neatly cropped. Wes walked toward him with confidence. This was his fighting force. This was his command. His mind was tumbling between dealing with the size of these ships and how they had existed on this planet for millennia without being detected by the most advanced surveillance equipment humans could muster. But they were looking for a submarine or a drone, a tiny fraction this size. Still, he wondered at how something 100 times the size of the largest aircraft carrier could be sitting on the bottom of the sea or cruising on orbit over their heads without detection. He felt as though he had walked into the ring for a cage fight, realizing that the promotional pictures did not prepare him for the size and power of his opponent. But this was not his opponent. This was his ally. Within a few minutes, the marching assembly of men would arrive. He stepped forward resolutely and brought his arm up to extend his hand to the figure more than 10 feet tall, standing in front of him in a loose semblance of attention. The being moved his head swiftly, like an insect looking down at its prey coming within range. The eyes were large and appeared to have 5 pupils arranged inside the colored sphere that made up each eyeball. The forehead was large, but not out of proportion with the head, like he had imagined. He extended his open hand and met Wes's with a grip that felt bony to the touch, like the hand was made of metal. It was cool to the touch and powerful. The 5 fingers were longer than humans, with an extra knuckle allowing them to nearly wrap around his own. The thumb was long and broad behind his hand, and applied enough pressure that he knew it could break his bones with ease. There was a precision to his movement, like a fighter who could move with speed, strength, and accuracy. This being was a warfighter. He was formidable, but did not frighten him as much as Semyaza did for his first few years at NORAD. "General Wes Morley," said Wes, finally looking at the center of the 5 pupils in each eyeball. The being released his grip and let Wes withdraw his hand. He lifted his left hand, and in it he had a small case. He gripped the case with 3 fingers, while the other 2 fingers worked the latch and opened the lid. Inside were 2 small devices. He picked one of the devices from the case and slipped it over his right ear. Wes could see that the device looked like the old Bluetooth devices that fit over the ear and provided a small microphone that extended forward along the cheek. Wes picked the 2nd device and slipped it over his own ear where it felt comfortable. "My name is Ishlok Titlan. I am the leader of this armada, at your disposal by the command of Semyaza," said the being. His voice was smooth and deep, but the dialect was something he had never heard before. There were 2 tones to it, indicating there were more than 2 vocal cords. The longer cords gave a vibration that was not unlike Semyaza's voice, but the shorter set added a series of clicks and high-pitched singing tones, very much like a dolphin. The tones were capable of carrying more information, because the being's sounds stopped before the translation earpiece completed the message. "I am General Wes Morley, military commander of Earth," said Wes again into the translator. He decided to call him Ishto, sensing the Mayan roots in his name. He had taken a class in ancient Mayan battle codes during his intelligence training. The most widely used encryption techniques were developed by Native American tribes. It was the world's only complex language that was only taught orally and never written down. Mayan battle codes had been used successfully for more than 1,500 years against enemies, including superior technologies utilized by the Spanish. "Your men will be accepted aboard after suitable screening for disease. My people lack some immunities. You understand my concerns," said Ishto. "My medical staff will work with yours. We have redundant crews capable of staffing a battle group. I want to begin immediately, if that's possible," said Wes. "I will deploy the proper resources," said Ishto, and he pulled a small silver rod from his jacket pocket and spoke into it without the use of his translator. Wes could not detect any words, because only the shorter set of vocal cords was used. The stream of syllables was continuous, with some of them above the range of human hearing. Within seconds he heard the ship above them begin vibrating. A large door slid open, revealing the bright interior of the front of the ship. Another craft began to descend to the concrete pad where they were standing. It was dark in color and was roughly the size of a 3-story office building. It settled silently onto the concrete, and the front of it opened to reveal a long hallway. Your people will remove their clothing and enter here. The process is quick and relatively painless. The outer layer of skin is removed with a flash of light. They will be washed. They will be provided clothes, and their fluids will be examined for disease. Infected individuals will be returned, not permitted to enter the ship. The rest will be admitted and trained. I will report in 3 days with their progress, Ishto said. It is acceptable. I will inform my officers. Thank you, Ishtoctiglan, said Wes, offering a salute out of habit. Ishto lifted his right hand to reveal his palm and the fingers together. It surprised Wes how much it looked like the salute used by the Nazis. He withdrew his salute slowly and dropped his hand to his side. It was a sign of respect, but Wes waited without moving. He looked Ishto in the eyes and did not move. The test of wills would continue. He could see this as Ishto dropped his hand to his side as well, turned and walked back toward the building that dropped from the ship above them. Wes did a sharp about-face and marched toward the colonel, who had just arrived with the first platoon and halted. The second was forming up to its left, and he came to a stop next to the colonel. Colonel, I have spoken to the fleet commander. His name is Ishtoctitlan, he said, sounding it out for him. You will be given a translator, but first your men have to be processed for health compliance. The outer skin will be lasered to clean off the contaminants, and each man will be sampled for fluids, checked for incompatible disease, and clothing provided. Rejects will be expelled from the program. Understand? Asked Wes. Yes, sir. When do we start, sir? Asked the colonel. Right now. Send them in, single file. I will return in 3 days to check on your progress. Cooperation is the key to success here, said Wes. Yes, sir, said the colonel. And colonel? Paused Wes. Yes, sir. Every soul on that world dies cursing God. That planet goes home with no one. Understood? Said Wes with darkness on his voice. Yes, sir, said the colonel with the energy of a soldier. May I ask a question, sir? Wes set his jaw and looked the colonel in the eyes. I'm listening. These ships, these aliens, they could do this without us. Why? Began the colonel. Their weapons are powerful, but there are rules when it comes to using them. This is our war, not theirs. We are getting a weapons upgrade because we are out of time, Colonel, said Wes with the loudest whisper he could muster. What are the rules, sir? Asked the colonel, no longer guarding his promotion. We are the children of the Lightbringer. It is he that gives us life, wealth, power, and dominion over our enemies. These ships contain our distant cousins by marriage, leftovers from a former creation. This world is ours. These planets are ours, said Wes. Sir, I am sure we can wipe every living thing from that world. But how will we know when the mission is completed? Asked the colonel. When they begin killing themselves rather than waiting for death, said Wes coldly. Yes, sir. I understand, sir. The fear of God, sir, said the colonel. They will curse God and die. Now go and do, spat Wes. Yes, sir, said the colonel, snapping a salute to his forehead. Wes brought his right arm up slowly with his hand flat and his fingers together with the tips of the fingers close to the brim of his four-star hat. He held it for a second while looking deep into the resolute eyes of his colonel, and then snapped to his side. Carry on, colonel. With that, General Wes Morlaix performed a perfect about-face, led off with his left foot, and marched toward his waiting electric cart.